Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take a stack of information and unpack the most important nuggets of knowledge and insight for you. Today, we're embarking on a really fascinating deep dive into a world that's rapidly gaining traction in health and wellness, peptides and bioregulators.
It is, yeah. It's a truly promising field, offering a unique approach. It really looks at addressing the root causes of many health challenges, you know, rather than just managing symptoms.
Right.
So our mission today is to cut through some of the complexity, give you a clear, actionable understanding of some of the most discussed compounds, and help you grasp not just what they are, but why they truly matter for your well-being.
We've drawn insights from an expert who has spent, well, decades immersed in this space, bringing his extensive experience with these compounds to the forefront. So if you've been curious about what peptides are, how they work, or maybe if they could be beneficial for you, this deep dive is really tailor-made to get you well-informed. Okay, let's unpack this crucial information. Our journey into this fascinating world, it begins by charting the landscape a bit. What exactly are these compounds, and why has a field with such a long history only recently, you know, captured mainstream attention? Let's start with peptides. I've heard them described as signaling molecules or maybe fractionated proteins. What's the core truth there?
You're spot on there. Peptides are essentially signaling molecules. Think of them as short chains of amino acids, naturally produced by the human body.
Okay.
They act like tiny messengers, basically telling cells and tissues what to do. Now, when we talk about them in a supplemental context, they are synthetically manufactured to mimic these natural compounds.
Right, synthetic versions.
Yeah. And what's truly fascinating is their history. Peptides have been known since the 1920s and 30s.
Wow, that long.
Oh, yeah. And interestingly, Russia has had extensive clinical use of both peptides and bioregulators for over 65 years. We're talking detailed research, peer review.
65 years.
Mm-hmm. Here in the West, clinical interest really only picked up speed around, say, 2016, 2017. Although underground communities, particularly in bodybuilding, they were using them way back in the early 2000s.
That's a huge timeline difference.
Oh.
So despite them occurring naturally and this long history of use elsewhere, why do peptides still seem to be in this regulatory gray area with the FDA here in the States,
yeah,
even as they're exploding in popularity?
That's a really vital distinction. The regulatory landscape in the U.S. is just, well, it's slower to adapt.
Okay.
But the core function of peptides, that remains transformative. They aim to address the fundamental root cause of disease, disorder, and dysregulation.
Right. The root cause.
Exactly. When used judiciously, precisely, they can facilitate remarkable healing, often in ways that are difficult for conventional medications. It really aligns with the principles of functional medicine.
And what about bioregulators? I've heard that term gaining some awareness recently. How do they differ from peptides? And what's their regulatory standing?
Yeah, bioregulators are a distinct category. A key difference from peptides is there's less of that regulatory gray area in the U.S. The FDA, Big Pharma, the AMA, they generally view them as supplements.
So like vitamins or minerals.
Pretty much. Which means they can be sold without restriction, even on places like Amazon.
And there's a real push now, isn't there, to bring bioregulator awareness more mainstream. I've seen new companies like BioLongevity Labs popping up.
Exactly. The challenge currently, however, revolves around the supply chain for the patented forms.
Okay.
The ones often called Kavinsin bioregulators, originating from Russia. Ongoing global events have created some significant supply issues.
Right, that makes sense.
And this also raises quality concerns, you know, as patents are being relicensed to other companies following the original creator's passing in January 2023. But at their core, bioregulators are unique because they are tissue-specific in their action, meaning a specific bioregulator targets and helps optimize a specific organ or tissue.
Interesting. Tissue-specific.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now that we've sort of mapped out what they are, let's talk about the art of using them. It's clearly not as simple as just taking a multivitamin, right?
Right.
What should listeners know about, say, proper dosing and cycling?
You've hit on a critical point there. Dosages are highly individualized. They depend entirely on your specific needs, whether you're dealing with an acute injury, a long-standing issue, or maybe you're just looking for maintenance and optimization. There's truly no one-size-fits-all approach.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I've also heard about the body developing resistance over time, something called receptor attenuation or antibody resistance, where the peptides become less effective. How does that work, and what do you do about it?
That's a crucial aspect. Your body is smart, it adapts, and sometimes becomes less responsive.
Mm-hmm.
The solution is to cycle off them. A general guideline we often recommend is be off for maybe 3 to 4 weeks if you've been on for 4 to 6 weeks.
All right.
If you're on for a longer period, say 8 to 12 weeks, then an off cycle of maybe 4 to 6 weeks is appropriate. The off cycle period can generally be a bit shorter than the on cycle.
And are there any signs you can look for? Anything that indicates you might be developing this resistance?
Well, one clear indicator of antibody buildup is increased intracellular water retention.
Intracellular. Oh. So water inside the cells.
Exactly. Your cells are holding on to more water than they should. It can be a subtle sign of resistance building up.
What about that common protocol you sometimes hear about, the 5 days on, 2 days off? Is that effective for everyone?
That's a great question. While it can be effective, especially for some growth hormone-releasing peptides, its utility really depends on your age.
Ah, age is a factor.
Big time. For individuals, say, in their 30s to 40s, it can allow the pituitary gland to reset, maintain sensitivity. However, for those over 50, where natural IGF-1 production, that's insulin-like growth factor 1.
Right. Crucial hormone.
Yeah, critical for growth, metabolism.
Mm.
When that significantly declines, the benefit of that protocol is often minimal.
Why is that?
Because peptides work by enhancing what the body naturally produces. So if your natural production is low, there's less for the peptide to stimulate. Older individuals often find more benefit from, say, direct growth hormone therapy.
Okay, that distinction makes sense. So how do these compounds actually get into your system to do their work? What are the most impactful delivery systems?
Right, delivery. Well, when we look at the systems, injection is consistently the highest impact method.
Injection first.
Especially when done in a fasted state. It crosses the blood-brain barrier fastest, doesn't have to compete with insulin.
Okay.
The second most effective is probably intranasal administration, you know, snorting or nasal sprays. It also crosses the blood-brain barrier effectively.
Intranasal, okay.
After that, you've got oral or transdermal methods, lotions, creams. Their effectiveness really varies depending on the specific peptide's molecule size and the formulation. Mm. And we're also seeing newer technologies popping up like patches and troches, those dissolving lozenges.
Okay, now for the part I think many people have been waiting for. Let's embark on our alphabetical deep dive into specific peptides and bioregulators. Maybe we can group them by their primary functions, make it a bit easier to follow their unique contributions.
Sounds like a good plan.
Group one. Energy and mitochondrial optimization.
All right, let's kick off with compounds that promise to revitalize your energy right down at the cellular level. First up, 5-amino-1-MQ. Now, I know this one's technically a small molecule, but it always seems to come up in peptide discussions. What's its superpower?
Think of 5-amino-1-MQ as like an internal battery booster for your cells. The key insight here is it directly targets your mitochondria, your cellular powerhouses. That makes it a real game changer for sustained energy, enhanced endurance, and improved gym performance. Things like running faster, jumping higher.
Sounds incredibly powerful. But what are some of the practical challenges I've heard talk about the body getting used to it quickly? Is that the receptor attenuation you mentioned earlier?
You're exactly right. That's its main challenge, that rapid receptor attenuation. New users might see benefits for, say, 8 to 10 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But highly optimized individuals, their bodies adapt faster. They might only get 4 to 6 weeks before needing a break because resistance builds up quickly.
Okay, so cycling is key there. Next, MOTSC, another mitochondrial optimizing peptide. Where does this one fit into the energy picture?
MOTSC is interesting. It actually seems to work better in individuals who are more insulin resistant and have less mitochondrial optimization to begin with.
Really? Better if you're less optimized?
Yeah, kind of counterintuitive, right? For those with compromised mitochondrial health, it can provide a really significant energetic fire.
Right.
But for already optimized individuals, the boost is less pronounced.
So where does it rank? Power-wise.
In terms of noticeable mitochondrial activation, I'd say it sits between SS31, which is probably the most powerful, and 5-amino-1-MQ, kind of in the middle.
Which brings us perfectly to SS31. I hear this is becoming a real favorite for some. What makes it so remarkable?
Ah, SS31. It's definitely one of my current favorites, yeah. It has truly profound effects on mitochondrial optimization.
How so?
Its impact is, well, remarkable because it seems to make everything else you do or take better.
Interesting.
It subtly enhances gym performance. Maybe you squeeze out a few more reps with the same weight, boosts overall energy, even sexual performance. But it does all this without causing jitters or that wired feeling.
And you don't need much.
No, a tiny microdose is often sufficient to get significant benefits, even for people who are already pretty mitochondrially optimized. It's often incorporated into like a daily or every other day injection stack.
Very cool. And finally, in this energy group, NAD plus. This one's pretty widely known for boosting energy levels, improving cognitive function.
NAD plus is indeed celebrated for those benefits, yeah. It's available via IVs, though it can be inconvenient and, frankly, uncomfortable for some.
Mm-hmm.
And also injections, which many people report significant benefits from. For maintenance, a therapeutic microdose once or twice a week is pretty common.
Do you need to cycle off NAD plus about?
It's not strictly necessary like with some others, but taking a break, maybe 2 to 3 weeks every 4 months, can be beneficial. Response varies widely, though. Some people feel dramatic benefits. Others, especially those with naturally high NAD plus levels, which you can test for, might feel very little effect.
And patches are becoming an option, too?
Yes, patches are an emerging delivery method as well. Definitely want to watch.
Group two, repair and regeneration.
Okay, let's shift our focus now to compounds that actively help with recovery, repair, tissue regeneration. We have a really powerful duo here, BPC-157 and TB-500. What makes this combination so effective for healing?
This combo is incredibly potent for regenerating soft tissue and cells, really throughout the body.
Okay.
BPC-157 specifically, it enhances androgen receptor sensitivity.
What does that mean practically?
It means it can make the body more responsive to hormones like testosterone, so it's useful for people on therapeutic hormone regimens.
Got it.
It also aids in hair regrowth. That's due to its angiogenic properties, meaning it promotes new blood vessel formation.
Mm-hmm.
And it supports nerve fiber regeneration, too. It's quite comprehensive.
That is a serious healing profile. And for application, it seems like even microdoses work for mild stuff, like sprains.
Right.
But if you inject for a targeted injury, where exactly should it go?
Yeah, even small amounts help. For injections into injured areas, the advice is usually to inject into the skin above the area, not directly into a tendon.
Why not directly into the tendon?
It can cause significant pain if you go right into the tendon itself. Injecting just above it allows it to permeate the area effectively without that intense discomfort. I've heard some pretty amazing anecdotal stories, really, about its rapid healing capabilities for everything from joint pain to gut issues.
Wow. Okay, let's talk about GHKQ, the copper peptide. I love that nickname, the ShamWow peptide,
yeah,
because it's so versatile. What does it do for us?
Huh? Yeah, it's a fitting description. It significantly improves skin elasticity, enhances angiogenesis, that new blood vessel formation, again, specifically in the skin.
Okay.
And it can regrow hair, but only in areas where you still have active hair follicles. It won't, you know, bring back hair on a completely bald head.
Right. And for topical use, like creams, there's a specific grade or concentration that matters for efficacy, isn't there?
Absolutely. For real impact, it must be at least a 3% grade.
3%.
Yeah. And a key indicator of a real effective product is this distinct purple sheen it leaves on the skin when applied.
Purple sheen, okay.
A lot of high-end cosmetic products claim to contain GHKQ, but they might have proprietary blends that aren't actually effective or the concentration is too low.
What about injecting it?
Well, while injecting GHKQ is highly effective, it can cause a pretty severe burning sensation.
Ouch.
Yeah. And it seems to be more pronounced in individuals with darker skin tones, possibly due to higher melanin levels. So transdermal application, the cream at 3% grade, is often just as effective without that discomfort.
Good to know.
And because of its strong angiogenic nature, it also helps with a general healing and red blood cell formation, similar in ways to BPC-157. Some people getting hair transplants even injected around the graft areas to help strengthen them.
Group three, cognitive and neurological support.
All right, let's delve into compounds targeting brain health, cognitive function. First up, cerebrolysin. This one's derived from pigs, I believe, and has some pretty remarkable reported effects on the brain.
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
Cerebrolysin can play a really significant role in treating early stage dementia and Alzheimer's. There are even reported cases of reversal using high doses.
Reversal? That's incredible.
It is. It also helps address unstable blood sugar, which we know is a major contributor to various neurological diseases.
What's truly remarkable, I think, is its use in places like the Balkans. I heard that high-dose cerebrolysin is actually administered in emergency vehicles for things like heart attacks, vascular incidents, strokes. That's a powerful endorsement.
Yes, it demonstrates its ability to, quote, literally bring them back from a vascular occlusion.
Mm-hmm.
It's a practice not common here in the U.S., but it's a testament to its potency.
How does it work? What's the mechanism?
It involves repairing neurotransmitter pathways and boosting levels of serotonin and dopamine.
Okay, so given those effects on neurotransmitters, should someone be cautious if they're already taking SSRIs, those common antidepressants?
Yeah, there are potential competing issues if you're on SSRIs, though frankly, most users seeking cerebralysin for serious conditions aren't typically on them at the same time. It's generally considered more of a, last-ditch effort or the biggest tool in the tool belt for serious neurodegenerative conditions. For just general cognitive enhancement, cautious microdosing would be the suggested approach.
It actually reminds me of the persistent tension headaches you mentioned I used to get. Those are often vascular related, right?
They often are, yeah.
So optimizing those underlying vascular pathways, potentially with something like this, or maybe others we'll discuss, could potentially alleviate issues like that.
It's certainly plausible, targeting the root vascular component.
Okay, now let's group some of the real heavy hitters for cognitive enhancement: Dihexa, Selank, and Cmax. What do these offer, and how do they maybe differ from each other?
Right, the nootropics. All three significantly improve cognitive function. They can help restore dopamine signaling pathways, which is incredibly beneficial for issues stemming from maybe lack of sleep or even prolonged SSRI use.
Is there a hierarchy among them?
Based on reported experience, yeah, Dihexa is often ranked highest for overall cognitive restoration, then usually Selank, followed by Cmax.
And specific effects?
And Selank tends to have a more calming, anxiety-reducing effect. So it's useful if mental calm is a goal. Dihexa and Cmax are primarily seen as cognitive restorers and enhancers.
And dosing with these powerful nootropics, I imagine you have to be careful.
Absolutely crucial to start low and go slow. Individual sensitivity varies wildly. Some people feel profound effects from just a microdose, while others might need what you'd call a heroic dose, maybe 40, 50 milligrams of Dihexa, for example.
And how are they usually taken?
These nootropic peptides are often quite effective when taken orally or via nasal delivery. Both Cmax and Selank are also known to increase BDNF.
BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, that's the brain fertilizer stuff.
Right, exactly. Promotes growth and survival of brain cells.
Speaking of brain enhancement, what about tesofensine? I hear this one can profoundly impact overall well-being.
Tesofensine is definitely a powerful compound known for profoundly enhancing well-being. It's not exactly euphoric, but it creates this lasting feeling of just being amazing throughout the day.
Wow.
It also increases BDNF. The thing is, some individuals have extreme receptor sensitivity to it.
How extreme?
Like, they might experience effects like being unable to sleep for days, but while feeling highly energized and productive.
Whoa, so dosing must be key.
Critically important. Start very low, maybe 125 micrograms, which is just half a capsule, because it's so potent, especially if you might be highly sensitive. That first month of use is often described as unforgettable because the positive feelings can be so profound.
What about those rumors of hair loss? Sometimes linked to BDNF.
Yeah, those rumors exist. But it's often attributed more to protein malnutrition, similar to the hair loss sometimes seen with GLP-1 users who aren't consuming enough protein, rather than a direct effect of the BDNF itself.
Group 4, growth hormone optimization.
Okay, let's move on to the peptides that are really all about optimizing your body's natural growth hormone production. That's crucial for everything from muscle growth to skin health. All right, let's start with CJC-1295.
Right. CJC-1295 is a potent growth hormone releasing agonist. It's known for significantly stimulating IGF-1 production. You often find it combined in vials with other peptides like apomorelin for synergistic effects.
But are there downsides?
Yeah. A common complaint is flushing or redness at the injection site, sometimes accompanied by hot flashes, which can be particularly uncomfortable for, say, perimenopausal women. It can also cause itchiness and redness sometimes.
Okay.
Because of those side effects, apomorelin is often preferred. It tends to yield comparable benefits, but with less discomfort for most people.
That leads us perfectly to apomorelin, which seems highly recommended. What makes it the sort of go-to growth hormone peptide, especially for newcomers?
Yeah, apomorelin is widely considered the number one growth hormone agonist peptide for newcomers.
Why is that?
Its key advantage, and this is supported by clinical studies, is that it's the only growth hormone agonist that does not suppress the body's own natural growth hormone production.
Oh, that's a big difference.
Huge difference. It's particularly powerful for women, too. It aids in sleep quality, improves skin elasticity and quality, promotes significant fat loss. It also just enhances general well-being, and it's highly synergistic with therapeutic testosterone.
How about dosing, particularly for women?
For women, A good starting point is usually 100, 200 micrograms right before bed. You could potentially increase to 300 micrograms. Dosing just once a day is usually sufficient.
And how long can you use it?
New users can often see benefits for up to 12 mics. More experienced users might notice that receptor sensitivity starts to fade after maybe 6 to 8 weeks, requiring a break then. It can dramatically modulate body composition, reduce fat in stubborn areas, especially for women in their mid-30s to early 40s who still have healthy IGF-1 levels.
Then there's tesamorelin. This is actually an FDA-approved drug, isn't it? What's its unique strength?
That's right. Tesamorelin is considered the number one growth hormone releasing peptide, and it is FDA approved under the name Egfrida.
Egfrida, okay.
It was originally developed to treat lipodystrophy. That's the hard visceral fat accumulation often seen in men with HIV. It's incredibly effective at breaking up this stubborn belly fat.
So it's primarily a fat loss peptide.
For belly fat, it acts like a hot knife through butter. It's superior to any other peptide in that specific regard. However, it's not really beneficial for individuals who already lack significant belly fat. It also generally improves well-being.
What's the main challenge with tesamorelin, given how potent it is?
Because it's so powerful, it causes very rapid receptor sensitivity attenuation.
That resistance again.
Yeah, it often stops being effective after only about 5 weeks. A key sign it stopped working is noticeable water retention.
Okay.
And while it provides a massive growth hormone bolus, it's often just too strong for women seeking general GH benefits. For women's longevity, skin quality, overall fat loss, epomorelin is usually a better choice.
Makes sense. Now, speaking of older options, what about GHRP2 and GHRP6 and also hexarelin? Are these still relevant or have they been mostly replaced?
Well, GHRP2 and GHRP6, while they do stimulate growth hormone, they also significantly increase prolactin and cortisol.
Which isn't good.
No, those are negative hormonal side effects. Can lead to disturbed sleep, increased stress responses. Given that we now have newer, more advanced peptides like epomorelin and tesamorelin that offer GH release without those side effects, GHRP2 and 6 are generally advised to be avoided.
And hexarelin.
Similar story. Hexarelin is a strong GH agonist, but it's becoming increasingly difficult to find. And like the older GHRPs, it can cause increases in cortisol and prolactin, maybe less severely, but still, compared to epomorelin or tesamorelin, its side effect profile just makes it a less optimal choice today.
Got it. Next, sermorelin. I understand this was sort of created by the clinical community to mimic epomorelin, but what's the practical difference for users? Is it really the same?
Sermorelin's interesting, yeah. The clinical community created it because epomorelin wasn't initially supported by the FDA, and chemically, they are very similar.
But do they feel the same?
That's the thing. Despite the chemical similarities, users consistently report that epomorelin yields a much more pronounced effect.
Like what?
Deeper sleep, greater fat loss, and importantly, fewer side effects compared to sermorelin. It's often jokingly called the Pepsi challenge among users.
Oh.
And epomorelin pretty much always wins. So while doctors working with compound pharmacies might recommend sermorelin, it's usually worth specifically requesting epomorelin for superior results.
Good tip. And finally, for this growth hormone group, MGF and IGF-1 plus MOD-GRF. These are also known for muscle building potential. What's the story here? Why aren't they more common?
Right. MGF, mechanogrowth factor, and IGF-1-DES, these interstitial growth factor peptides, are potentially amazing for muscle building and enhancing GH secretion. And MOD-GRF specifically is a potent muscle builder, particularly for local muscle growth.
Local bro.
Yeah, it can be injected directly into lagging muscle group, say, the upper chest, to enhance site-specific development, provided you're training and eating right, of course.
So what's the catch?
The major hurdle with all of these is their extreme instability. They become inert, basically useless, and destabilize very rapidly if they aren't compounded or manufactured absolutely correctly. They also have a very short half-life, meaning you have to use them very quickly after reconstitution.
So they're hard to get right.
Extremely hard to get in a stable, effective form, which means, practically speaking, using direct growth hormone is often a more reliable alternative if that's the goal. They're not outdated technology, just very difficult to obtain in a clinically efficacious way.
Group 5, metabolic and longevity boosters.
Okay, let's explore compounds that target metabolic health and maybe even life extension. First, Epitalon and Thymolin. What are these exactly and what's their connection to longevity?
These are actually bioregulators, though you often see them sold alongside peptides. They're quite well known for their potential life extension properties.
How do they work?
They improve telomerase expression. Telomerase is the enzyme that helps maintain the protective caps on our DNA, called telomeres.
Right, the ends of the chromosomes.
Exactly. As we age, telomeres tend to shorten. By boosting telomerase, epitalon and thymolin theoretically help maintain telomere length, which helps resist aging mechanisms like the accumulation of senescent cells or zombie cells and oxidative waste.
How are they typically used?
Most experts recommend taking them together, usually in a 10-day course, maybe twice a year, for someone around age 50, for example.
And this ties into biological age testing, measuring telomere length.
It does, yes. Companies like True Diagnostic measure telomere length as part of biological age assessment.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, be cautious with this field. It's still a bit like the Wild Wild West.
Mm-hmm.
It's emerging, it's not fully standardized, and you can get conflicting results between different testing companies.
Fair point. And ultimately, it brings us back to a fundamental longevity link.
Yeah.
Body composition, right?
Absolutely. Being lean is statistically the number one criterion for living long and strong. Research shows men between, say, 12-15% body fat and women 16-22% statistically live longer. That visceral body fat, the stuff around the organs, is strongly linked to inflammation and disease.
Definitely key. Now, another bioregulator called pancreagin, what does this one do for our metabolism?
Pancreagin is specifically designed to strengthen the pancreas.
Okay.
It helps enhance insulin sensitivity and suppress blood glucose, somewhat similar to metformin, but it acts directly on the pancreas itself. It strengthens the chemokine receptors in the pancreas that can degrade over time, often due to poor dietary habits.
Interesting. Targeting the pancreas directly. Now, before we continue our peptide deep dive, it feels crucial to address a really foundational compound often discussed in this whole space, even though it's technically not a peptide. Let's briefly step aside to explore metformin and its profound role.
Absolutely essential to cover metformin. Yes, correct. It's not a peptide. It's a widely studied medication originally developed for type 2 diabetes, and it's derived from a plant, believe it or not.
From a plant? Wow.
Yeah. For individuals who are metabolically deranged, it can significantly improve health, even without immediate drastic lifestyle changes. But even for already optimized individuals, it profoundly reduces systemic inflammation.
Including inflammation in the brain.
Yes, including that silent inflammation in the brain. And it increases beneficial gut bacteria like Akkermansia, making the gut incredibly resilient against issues like dysbiosis.
And it seems quite accessible, even though it's technically a prescription drug.
That's right. Because it's off-patent, it's readily available, often through telehealth or compound pharmacies, as an oral tablet. Typical dosing might be 500 milligrams twice daily for men, maybe 250 milligrams twice daily for women. There's also an extended-release version, which helps with tolerance.
Any initial side effects?
It might cause some mild nausea or uneasiness initially, mainly as it starts working on the gut bacteria, but that typically subsides pretty quickly.
And it's being studied for anti-aging.
Yes. It's currently the subject of the large TANN trial, targeting aging with metformin. Early indications are confirming its remarkable benefits for longevity and health span.
And I've heard it's highly recommended specifically for women with autoimmune diseases. Why is that connection so strong?
Absolutely. Because it can dramatically reduce systemic inflammation and the related symptoms. It can make a significant difference for those battling autoimmune conditions. Honestly, there's a strong sentiment that the conventional medical system often doesn't want people on metformin.
Really? Why?
Because its preventative effects on so many common illnesses are so profound, it essentially keeps people healthier and out of hospitals. It's incredibly effective and inexpensive.
Fascinating perspective. Okay, back to the peptides and related compounds. Let's talk about the powerful retatrutide, one of the newer GLP-1 agonists. What makes this one different from others, like semaglutide or Ozempic?
Retatrutide, yes. It's an Eli Lilly drug currently in stage 3 trials. It's expected to be, well, highly expensive upon release.
No surprise there.
Right. But clinical trials show it is truly transformative. It apparently destroys, quote unquote, other GLP-1s like semaglutide and tirzepatide or Mounjaro when it comes to addressing metabolic dysregulation.
How is it different?
Its key differentiator is that, unlike the others, it significantly boosts metabolism, but with less appetite suppression.
Less appetite suppression? That seems counterintuitive for weight loss.
It does. But the metabolic boost is so strong that high clinical trial doses, like 4 to 6 milligrams a week, can paradoxically make already optimized individuals feel ravenous because their metabolism is just supercharged.
So for optimized use, lower, carefully titrated doses seem to be the key then.
Yes, absolutely. At lower, carefully titrated doses, maybe taken daily or every other day, it can be highly effective. It can even be combined with other peptides like melanotan-1, SS31, or BPC-TB500 in a single injection.
And what's crucial to understand about using GLP-1s in general, beyond just picking the compound itself, seems like there's more to it.
This is vital. GLP-1s are often overprescribed, frankly, at very high doses by doctors simply chasing weight loss numbers.
Mm-hmm.
This can lead to significant muscle loss, metabolic dysregulation down the line, even thyroid issues, and a slowed basal metabolic rate if it's not combined with proper nutrition and exercise.
So what's the right way?
A crucial protocol for success with any GLP-1 requires an insulin-controlled diet, managing carbohydrates effectively. Adequate protein intake is non-negotiable, aiming for about 1 gram per pound of targeted body weight. This is especially vital for women who are often protein malnourished to begin with.
Okay, diet and protein. What else?
Consistent bone bearing or resistance training alongside cardiovascular exercise. And critically, it's essential to address any underlying hormone deficiencies before or while starting GLP-1s to prevent that significant muscle loss.
Finding the right doctor seems key then.
Absolutely. The importance of finding a clinician who actually educates patients on these critical lifestyle elements, rather than just handing out high doses for quick but potentially damaging weight loss, cannot be stressed enough.
Good advice. Speaking of GLP-1s, what about the most famous one, semaglutide, Ozempic, Wegovy? What's its place in this evolving landscape now?
Well, semaglutide, while it's obviously very well known, it's generally considered less effective and tends to cause more nausea compared to the newer GLP-1s like retatrutide or tirzepatide.
So less valuable now?
In my view, yes. It's seen as less valuable now that superior alternatives are available. Its primary utility might eventually be for individuals in, say, third world countries who can't access the more advanced injectable options, or perhaps for the oral capsule forms, which, although less effective than injections, can still offer some benefit.
Okay. Now, a bioregulator called vasolutin, what does this do for our circulatory system? Sounds vascular.
It is. Vasolutin dramatically optimizes blood flow. It works directly on the vascular system and the venous architecture.
Wow.
It helps cleanse the arterial, vascular, and capillary pathways, basically clearing out the crud, things like free oxidative waste, senescent cells that accumulate.
Does that help with things like headaches?
It can be beneficial for headaches that are specifically vascular related, yes, because it improves blood pressure regulation and overall flow. Generally, there isn't really a downside to increased oxygenated blood flow.
Unless
it's combined with a lack of exercise. That can potentially lead to blood thickening, which you sometimes see, for instance, in individuals on injectable testosterone who aren't performing regular cardio.
Group 6, specialized and potent compounds.
Okay, let's discuss some highly specialized or particularly potent compounds now. These might have very specific uses or require extra caution. First, FOXO4. This is a brain peptide being researched for its potential to cure or halt cancer progression. That sounds like a huge claim.
It's definitely an intriguing compound, yeah. The research is ongoing. However, practically speaking, it's difficult to obtain. It's expensive. And there's still ongoing debate about whether oral or injectable forms are more effective, though injection is generally considered higher impact for most peptides. So it's promising, still very much in the research phase.
Got it. Next, LO37. This one sounds intense.
LO37 is a highly potent antimicrobial, antipathogenic, and antiviral peptide.
Okay.
Because of its strength, the advice is generally to only use LO37 in really severe situations, like feeling so sick that you're about to die, kind of sick, or experiencing symptoms akin to severe viral infections.
So not for a common cold?
Definitely not.
Right.
It's also shown to be very beneficial for individuals with severe autoimmune diseases, things like lupus, Crohn's, or chronic Epstein-Barr, conditions that often involve massive systemic inflammation.
Wow. Okay. Now, a potentially controversial pair, melanotan-2 and melanotan-1. What's the crucial distinction here? Sounds like one is bad news.
Melanotan-2 is classified as very dangerous. Yes.
Right.
Known side effects include things like unwanted, persistent sexual arousal, severe nausea, vomiting, and it can even cause black spots to appear on the skin. We strongly advise avoiding melanotan-2 completely.
Okay. Avoid MT2. What about melanotan-1?
Melanotan-1, however, has a very different profile. Its primary function is to darken the skin, providing some insulation from the sun's negative effects. But it also seems to uniquely enhance consciousness, improve meditation focus, and foster a sort of creative mode. There's also some anecdotal evidence suggesting it can enhance sexual function.
Interesting. Creative mode.
Yeah, users often report a calming, centering effect alongside the tanning. As a starting point, a very small microdose, maybe 250 micrograms from a 10 milligram vial, taken just twice a week, say Monday and Thursday for about a month, is often suggested.
Okay, what about oxytocin, often called the bonding hormone?
Oxytocin, yeah. It can be beneficial for pair bonding, intimacy, sexual connection. However, it's known for being a bit hit or miss.
Hit or miss.
Yeah, some people experience profound effects, really feel that bonding increase. Others feel absolutely nothing.
Any idea why?
The variability might be due to interference from other substances in the bloodstream, like insulin, especially when it's trying to cross the blood-brain barrier. Injection is generally recommended for better consistency, though intranasal might work if you're completely fasted.
Okay. Now for PT41, also known as a bremelanotide, this one's more about sexual function.
Yes, PT41 is primarily a sexual stimulation drug. For men, it can strengthen erections, shorten the refractory period between erections, and lead to harder, firmer erections. High doses, though, can potentially cause prolonged unwanted erections priapism.
Okay, caution needed there. And for women.
For women, it's actually prescribed for hypoactive sexual desire disorder. It can lead to stronger orgasms and increased clitoral sensitivity.
But are there side effects?
Yes. And because it operates on similar pathways to melanotan 1 and 2, sensitivity can vary significantly. Some individuals experience severe nausea and sickness. Like with tesafensine, it's absolutely crucial to start with a very, very low
You
dosage.
got it. Start low. The last one on our alphabetical list, VIP, or vasoactive intestinal peptide.
Ah, VIP. This is another one of those remarkable, versatile peptides, but again, it's really recommended to save for when you're really sick.
Why save it?
Well, during the early stages of the COVID pandemic, some forward-thinking physicians observed that VIP could clear up severe cases of compromised airways in less than 24 hours.
24 hours for severe cases.
Yeah. The effects were so profound that the medical establishment reportedly limited or even banned its use in some areas.
Wow, how does it work?
It powerfully stimulates oxygen and carbon dioxide free flow. It makes it incredible for clearing blocked airways, infected sinus passageways. But again, because it's so potent,
Reserve it for last resort.
exactly. It should be reserved for situations of last resort where there's severe respiratory or airway compromise rather than used for just a mild illness.
This has been an incredible, really detailed deep dive into all these individual compounds. But before we wrap up, there's a foundational piece that seems to underpin everything we've discussed: the importance of optimizing your baseline hormones first.
This is absolutely critical. Yes. Think of your body's foundational hormones, things like testosterone, thyroid function, pancreas function, and we talked about metformin's role there. Think of those as the orchestra.
Okay, the orchestra.
Peptides, acting as these signaling molecules, they're like members of the symphony. They work far, far more effectively when that foundational orchestra is already optimized and properly dialed in.
So, a common mistake people make then is jumping straight into peptides without first checking for and addressing any underlying hormonal deficiencies. Sounds like that could lead to disappointment.
Precisely. It's a recipe for frustration. People might incorrectly conclude that peptides don't work for them when really the issue is the underlying hormonal imbalance wasn't addressed. And these hormonal deficiencies are increasingly common, even in younger individuals now, due to environmental factors, modern lifestyles, endocrine
So
disruptors.
the core recommendation then is always start with the foundation. Get comprehensive blood work, work with a knowledgeable doctor.
Yes, absolutely. Ensure your hormonal health is optimized first. Addressing these foundational issues allows peptides to exert their full, profound effects. It transforms them from potentially marginal helpers into truly transformative tools for holistic well-being. This whole approach, focusing on foundational optimization first and then using targeted molecular signaling like peptides or bioregulators, it represents a shift towards what I like to call quantum healing.
Quantum healing.
Yeah, empowering individuals to really take ownership of their health, moving beyond solely relying on traditional reactive medicine.
What a journey through this intricate world of peptides and bioregulators.
Yeah.
It's so clear that while these compounds hold incredible potential, understanding your own body's unique biochemical makeup and, crucially, ensuring your foundational health is dialed in first, that's paramount.
Indeed. And we are truly just at the infancy of this kind of personalized, really in-depth approach to health optimization. Imagine a future where understanding these signaling molecules, these bioregulators, is as common as, say, knowing about vitamins.
Yeah.
And where preventative root cause focused health becomes the absolute norm, not the exception.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, thinking about that future. What if, in the not-too-distant future, optimizing our health to such a precise degree means we don't just extend our lifespan, but we dramatically enhance our health span?
Mm-hmm. Living better, longer.
Exactly. Living with real vitality, high performance, well into our later years. Truly reaching maybe a golden age of human well-being. It's a fascinating thought. Keep exploring, keep learning, and thank you for joining us on this deep dive.